amplify her role as second best. And so Sarah watched him quietly. Even when he made ready to take their son Isaac with him on what was to be a sacrificial journey, she raised no questions. And finally, when all the provisions were secured, the child with great excitement was patted on the backside and sent over to bid his mother goodbye. And he rushed to her, hugged her excitedly, knocked his father aside as he raced into the courtyard and was seated astride his own beast. And when everything was ready, Abraham turned finally to look at Sarah squarely in the eyes for the first time that morning. They had learned that wonderful art that we married people learn eventually, the art of communicating in total silence. A raised eyebrow, a frown, a smile. It was in this inaudible way that they now spoke with each other, deep to deep. Finally, Abraham knelt beside Sarah and took her wrinkled face in his gnarled old hands, stared deeply into her eyes for a moment, and then pressed his matted gray beard against her forehead. And with one tear making a damp gully down his old dry cheek, he turned and walked quietly away into the young morning. All day long, Abraham pondered the words of God in his heart. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and there upon a mountain which I shall show you, offer him up as a burnt offering. When they finally reach the place of the sacrifice, Abraham once again exhibits his great love for this child of promise. He cuts the wood and gives Isaac the heavy load, but in his hands he carries the dangerous one. And they make their way up the mountainside to face the greatest test of this man's experience. All these years he had claimed to believe that God had called him out of the wilderness for a purpose. All of these years, Abraham had claimed that God's hand was on him in some unique and some special way. And now, as never before, God was calling this man to face the greatest test of his life. If you want my honest opinion, Abraham had every reason to walk outside his tent flap and clench his fist in the face of this strange and mysterious God and say, "Get off my back! I have purposely chosen an old man to use as an example of real faith." Because, you see, he had a reason to tell God to leave him alone. You don't. You have started from Ur, and if you look back soon enough, you can still see it at your age. But Abraham deserved to sit down and watch that child grow. He deserved to watch that boy enjoy all the enthusiasm that he could enjoy. He deserved to bounce a grandchild on that old knee. But it was to Moriah. With Abraham, it was always to Moriah. Now, it's on his journey to this mountain that I think he's caught up in the feeling all of us would be caught up with. Get off my back. But it's precisely because he faced it in the way that he did that he calls out of each of us who want to be like him two feelings simultaneously. We cannot help but feel on one hand a feeling of great admiration for his courage, while at the same time feeling great pity for the sorrow through which he moves. And it's living in this magnificent tension that he teaches us a great lesson of faith. You see, Abraham did not ask God for a lighter load. He prayed only for a stronger back. That's faith. That's belief. And emblazoned behind me are the words, "Because we believe." Abraham said it every time he stepped that day. And you'll say it if you want to learn his secret. In the sixth grade, I had a lesson in art, which I failed. I had that magnificent aesthetic experience of drawing a trash can. I never was good at drawing trash cans, or anything else for that matter. But in trying to draw a trash can, I had just really, really put it down on paper. You have rarely seen such true lines moving toward a center with a hole open at the top. I was splendid in defeat. And the teacher leaned over my shoulder and she said, "Grady, you forgot something." I started to say, "And you teach art." She said, "You forgot the shadows." I didn't see the shadows. I was looking at the trash can. You see, the shadows of experience bring out the depth and detail of life, of any portrait, of any picture. In order to bring out something of the rich quality of the life of Abraham, let me lay alongside his experience another story, which I hope will do for his story what shadows do for a picture. It's a story of a young man in the New Testament that I call R.Y.R. His real name is Rich Young Ruler. I somehow always abbreviate. R.Y.R. came to Jesus on one occasion, and with his robes flowing and his entourage preening behind him, he says to Jesus, "What a teacher. Oh, I really dig you. But tell me something." You must always remember the twinkle in the eye of Jesus when he talked to inquirers like R.Y.R. With a twinkle, he said, "What might that be, my friend?" He said, "All of these years, I have sought to keep the law diligently." Oh, I was a better law keeper than Grady Nutt was an art student. And Jesus says, "You have overlooked something." And he said, I hardly expect that to be true. You see, I've tithed and I have kept the laws and I've observed them diligently. But the reason I'm here, though, is to see if you really do think there's something I've overlooked. And if you're serious, I will listen. Jesus said, "From the look of your robes and the crowd around you, I would say that you're probably a very wealthy young man." Oh, right. Dad really left me well healed. And he said, "Well, I would say that probably the only thing standing in the way of your finding real happiness is your wealth." And now the young man's eyebrows look like private stripes. My wealth? Look, I came for a serious conversation, friends. You can't get any more serious than talking about your wealth. And in their discussion, Jesus points out to him that if he would really know happiness, and if he would really know the pleasure of God, he must be willing to take everything he has, sell it, give the proceeds to the poor, and come to follow this vagabond preacher, who, unlike foxes and squirrels and birds with places to sleep, had nowhere to lay his head. Talk about an original poverty program. He had it. And after this young man had walked away with his head shaking and his spirits drooping, Jesus turned to his disciples and this time without a twinkle, perhaps with a tear in his eye, said, "Isn't it tragic how some people hang on to the things that defeat them? It's a great deal easier for a rich man to completely miss heaven. In fact, a camel can get into an eye of a needle easier." These two stories for me of Abraham and the rich young ruler have become great teachers. They pointed out to me two men who wrestled with the ultimate question, what must I do to find favor in God's sight? And each man was given identically the same answer. Take that which is dearest to you. For one man, a promised child. For the other, a fat bank account. And be willing to sacrifice it for my sake. Given these orders, each man stands at the foot of Moriah trying to decide what he should do. and each man climbs his mountain. And before long, each man descends that mountain, and remarkably enough, each man has retained exactly what he thought was the most important thing in the world. But notice the difference in their attitudes. In the ancient step of Abraham, there's the spring of youth, while the dragging and dejected heels of the rich young ruler kick up the dust of heartbreak. I've often wondered what would have happened to R.Y.R. if he'd said on one occasion when Jesus challenged him, "All right, you give me 8 o'clock in the morning and I'll liquidate my assets and meet you at the edge of the county square." I honestly believe with all my heart that if he had ever told Jesus yes, Jesus would have said with a twinkle in both eyes, "Wait just a moment. What I really want is your willingness to part with your wealth, and since you have already given it away, bring it with you and let's dole it out as we see necessary." But you see, we'll never really know, because he would not bind his wealth, place it on the altar of sacrifice, and give God the opportunity to grip his wrist. This is where faith gets down to what it's all about. This is where belief affects everything that you are. What I want to talk with you about this evening is belief expressed. Belief manifested. The great phrase of our day is doing your own thing, not thinking your own thing. And when God did his thing, he called him Jesus. And he walked among us. And because God loved us, he expressed himself in the Word, made flesh. The verse that has literally transformed my own understanding of this man is John 1:14. "The Word became flesh and walked among us." One particular experience in his life has come to my mind as I've prepared to talk to you about this evening, and it's something I've not been able to escape. I've imagined the background to this story to have happened something like this. A Roman soldier coming through the community of Nazareth one day with a heavy, heavy load on his back, which most soldiers seemed to carry in those days. I don't know if it was from looting villages or getting ready to go help another one. I was never certain. But this Roman soldier with his great pack on his back comes through the village of Nazareth. And he spots 3 teenage boys standing over near one of the wells, evidently on some kind of work break. They all had on their aprons and cloaks and so forth. One young man, about 17 or 18 years of age, an especially good-looking fellow, seemed to be dominating the conversation at the moment, as the other two were laughing and joking and carrying on with him over a large gourd-handled cup that they were drinking from. Soldier walked over and, as was his privilege, drank from the cup and then ordered the taller, stronger, handsome young fellow to go with him for 1 mile from the village and carry his pack. Every Jew on his farm, beside his place of work, or beside his residence, had put down a post from which he measured out every road from his village exactly 1 mile. Then he drove down a stake, and he put a great big mark on it that in Hebrew went... Because that meant when he got there, the soldier couldn't make him carry his pack one step further. And they would not just walk up and turn around and say, "Sir, here's your pack." They would just drop it off their shoulders and go... Soldiers had to be pretty quick to catch their packs. Imagine the amazement and the delight of this soldier when he found a fellow that was willing to carry the pack without getting too ticked off. In fact, seemed to rather enjoy the walk. And the soldier thought, "I must come through this way again." They came to the milestone, which marked 1 mile from the village square. And the soldier was all braced to catch his pack, only to discover that the young man straightened it up a little bit stronger and said, I've got time to walk a little further. Now, the soldier was amazed, to put it mildly. He thought, what kind of trick is it? He knows a pitfall he's going to lead me into. He has buddies waiting up the road behind a rock, waiting to leap out and beat me to death. Or maybe he's going to carry it a little further because he has heart trouble and knows they will accuse me and hang me. So the soldier walked behind him this time with his hands under the pack. Yes, for another mile. Thoroughly expecting that he would be picking up the shrapnel left over when that pack hit the ground. And at the end of the second mile, instead of dropping the pack, the young man struggled to take it off, handed it to the soldier, helped him put it on, and then said, if you're ever in Nazareth again, we have a carpenter shop. You're welcome to stop in, spend the night, or rest a while. The soldier stood quietly and watched that young man walk away whistling after 2 miles of pack toting on a hot Palestinian day. That's why he could say later, when he was a grown man, Jesus of Nazareth, if you're commanded to carry a pack a mile, that's what you're supposed to do. That's legal. They can make you. But if in your heart you really care what happens to soldiers, walk another and make his day lighter. Somehow we seem to have gotten the idea, tragically, I think, that faith is to be expressed within the border limits of the first mile. When in reality, that's what's expected. That's what you should do. If you please, that's what you must do. You've had experiences this week of creative worship, giving some creative personal dynamic to expressing your own faith in God. That's always beyond the first milestone. Nobody was ever too creative in the first mile. Belief expressed. Belief laid upon people. Because my Father cares about you, I care about you too. We have a mistaken idea that the gospel will get a hearing just because it's the gospel. Don't ever believe it. The gospel gets its best hearing in the second mile. It gets its best hearing when you prove that there's something more to you than keeping rules and living by laws. Best two expressions I know that touch all of us directly, as college students who call ourselves mostly Baptists, are one organization called the Crusade for Christ, the other called Southern Baptist in the 1950s. These two ideas are not very far apart, if you want to be very honest. And if the Crusade for Christ bugs you a bit, I think it bugs you because it's probably a mirror of much of what you grew up on. You see, the Crusade for Christ holds out certain laws that, if kept, will guarantee you a relationship to your Heavenly Father. Southern Baptists have a program like that we grew up on in our evangelistic burst of the 50s, and we call it the Plan of Salvation. I want to point out something that may distress a few of you, but it's concerned me that if the Plan of Salvation were so all-fired important, why is it that not one single verse in the plan of salvation ever fell from the lips of Jesus? You answer me that. Not one. Why do we have to thread it together from Paul and Luke and Peter? If Jesus felt that clues and plans and laws were so all-fired important, Why did he not package it in one place himself and say, keep this law and live? He never did. And he never will. He never said, believe me. He said, follow me. Loving this world to life, not lawing this world to death. You ask me why there's spiritual dearth in our people. You ask me why you hunger for meaning. You ask me why we have never known the richness that Abraham found as he climbed Moriah. You ask me why we go away from life like the rich young ruler, eaten up because we have never known him. It's because we've lived on propositions and we've never come into relationship with him. And you've only got two alternatives. You will either live by propositions or you will live in proper relationship. I'm open to discussion, but those are the only two I have found. And when we talk about our lives lived for God, we are doing the will of God, not believing it. But let me hasten to add something that I think must be added. We make a tragic mistake when we think doing is the answer, just as we have made a tragic mistake in thinking that believing is the answer. Belief, properly expressed, is belief, but it is expressed in deeds. When you turn over the coin of creed, you find deed. They are inseparable. In the life of the man made whole. And when you find Jesus moving among people, what did he do? Did he say, if you will keep this rule, you will live? Did he say, if you will accept this idea, you will find wholeness? In almost every instance, he announced forgiveness and acceptance before they were even asked for. Because God loved, he sent Jesus to love. What will touch the lives of people where you move on campus? Believing love. What will cause us to find richness and purpose in our own faith? To know the man made flesh who mocked among us. Not divinity brought to earth, but humanity filled full. He was everything a man ought to be. He was everything a man could be. He was a man. And the most beautiful words then are, follow me. This way, please. In my footprints. Two scenes in the life of Jesus become extremely important to you at your particular stage of development as college students. The first of these, the scene in the temple, when he says to his parents, know ye not that I must be about my Father's business? And all of the scholars treat this passage as an awakening in this young man of his relationship to his heavenly Father. Notice how it's brought into clear focus later on in the second instance when he goes into the wilderness to wrestle with that identity as he lays it up against the world. We make a sad mistake when we think of the wilderness experience as the temptations in the wilderness. It's the decisions in the wilderness. Not what he could have done, what he did do. Not what he could have chosen, what he did choose. Not where he could have walked, where he did walk. And when this man came out of the wilderness, he brought his awareness that he was God's chosen man into contact with people. And his constant prayer, even to the cross, was, thy will be done. It started in the temple. It was forged in the wilderness. It bloomed on the cross. I don't offer you a whole lot less. And I don't say that you'll know it any more easily. But like Abraham, who faced the wilderness experience, you too can know the great peace that comes from following in the steps of this man. And you will discover that what you believe will affect what you do. And you will discover that what you do will bring richness to what you believe. A man once attracted a large crowd by walking a tight wire back and forth across a great chasm out west. He made this trip several times to the total fascination of the whole crowd, one particular spectator in particular. I completely identify with this spectator as he watched this man walk back and forth and back and forth across that tight wire, as a lady friend of mine in Texas says, in slack-jawed amazement. And as he walked across this chasm, finally he came off of the wire to his little perch, climbed down his ladder. He had complicated his feat moving across this by pushing a wheelbarrow. He managed to get it onto a hook and lowered it by a rope and stood there perspiring freely, wiping his hands off and getting himself braced to face this crowd with his little hat, which he used to collect money for his living. And this particular spectator rushed up, grabbed this man's hand and just shook it for all it was worth, and he said, in all my life, I've never seen anything like that. Absolutely fantastic. Back and forth and back and forth, and just heaped accolades on the man who had walked the wire, who finally began to blush a little because he was missing people heading for their cars with his hat. And in an effort to get this man out of the way so they could get on with the offering, he said, you think I could do that again? Do I think you could do it again? I saw you seven times back and forth across the room. Man, you are tough. I have never seen anything like that in all my life. Back. And the guy says, well, you really believe I know you could do it again? Know it. Well, how would you like to ride in the wheelbarrow? And you see, the rich young ruler stood beside Jesus and admired the great teacher. Oh, such truth has rarely fallen from mortal lips. But Abraham got in the wheelbarrow. And that makes all the difference in the world. Tonight, I don't promise you a crown. I don't promise you peace. I don't promise you happiness. And I don't promise you knowledge of tomorrow. Tonight, in Jesus' name, I offer you a wheelbarrow. And in a moment in our commitment experience, we're going to look at ourselves solidly and squarely.